is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A few days ago, Major League Baseball made an announcement that astonished some, and for some people, it was a long time coming. It was the announcement that former baseball great Pete Rose would be eligible for entry into baseball's Hall of Fame. This despite the fact that Pete Rose had a career that went down in flames because of a horrific gambling scandal, which took place, which was first revealed back in the 1980s. Ahead of that, Pete Rose had achieved a great level of distinction in the game of Major League Baseball as a working class guy from Cincinnati, Ohio. Not particularly brilliantly talented, but very, very tough and determined, hence his nickname, Charlie Hustle. And Pete Rose made the most of his gifts and actually ended up compiling more hits than anyone else in the history of baseball, and that is a record which still stands decades later. It made his fall from grace nothing less than a tragedy, which is explored in a book by Keith O'Brien called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith O'Brien is a much admired author who has written other books before this. His radio stories have appeared on NPR's All Things Considered and Morning Edition, and on other places as well. He has also written for the New York Times, New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, Slate, Esquire, and the Oxford American. A former staff writer for both the Boston Globe and the New Orleans Times Picayune. Actually a graduate from Northwestern University. This book published by Vintage, once again titled Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith O'Brien, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have done such a brilliant job of bringing this extraordinary figure of Pete Rose vividly to life. At one point, very early in the book, you describe Pete Rose as the most ordinary, extraordinary athlete in the history of American sports. Explain what you mean by that intriguing turn of phrase.
Well, I that is how I think about Pete Rose. You know, he, frankly, you know, was ordinary in many ways. He had ordinary talents. He had ordinary athleticism for the entirety of his childhood. And I mean, all the way through high school, he was never the best baseball player on his own team. And you know, despite all these things, you know, he gets a chance to play minor league baseball. And he gets that chance because he has, you know, one torrid stretch in the spring of 1960 in essentially a semi-pro league in Dayton, Ohio, and he's got a connection. His uncle Buddy is friends with the farm director of the Cincinnati Reds, so almost as a favor, you know, he gets an offer to go to Geneva, New York, to play for the Geneva Redlegs, And this is the lowest of the low of minor league baseball. It's a rung of baseball that's so low, it doesn't even exist anymore. And you know, he manages to do well there and move his way up. And all of these things just seem incredibly unlikely. In fact, you know, as I went back and looked at it, I think, frankly, it's almost miraculous that Pete Rose ever became Pete Rose.
Mm. And one thing I learned, among many things I learned from your book, is that this famous nickname he was given of Charlie Hustle was not meant as a compliment. It was attached to him by a couple of his rivals who were, in a sense, making fun of that sort of scrappy side of him. But it's a perfect nickname, isn't it?
It's a great nickname. Really becomes his persona. You know, Charlie Hustle is the kind of guy who will sprint down to first base on a walk, the kind of guy who will get into a fight at second base trying to break up a double play, the kind of guy who will, you know, run into a catcher at home plate and break his shoulder in a meaningless exhibition game. That's who Charlie Hustle is. And it is, I think, endlessly interesting that the nickname is bestowed upon him almost as sarcasm. You know, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford are watching him play in a spring training game in 1963, and they find it absurd how hard he is playing. But, you know, it would be easy, you know, say, coming from Mickey Mantle or Whitey Ford to make fun of Pete Rose. I mean, those guys were like the golden gods of
Keith O'Brien, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have done such a brilliant job of bringing this extraordinary figure of Pete Rose vividly to life. At one point, very early in the book, you describe Pete Rose as the most ordinary, extraordinary athlete in the history of American sports. Explain what you mean by that intriguing turn of phrase.
Well, I that is how I think about Pete Rose. You know, he, frankly, you know, was ordinary in many ways. He had ordinary talents. He had ordinary athleticism for the entirety of his childhood, and I mean all the way through high school. He was never the best baseball player on his own team. And you know, despite all these things, you know, he gets a chance to play minor league baseball. And he gets that chance because he has, you know, one torrid stretch in the spring of 1960 in essentially a semi-pro league in Dayton, Ohio. And he's got a connection. His uncle Buddy is friends with the farm director of the Cincinnati Reds. So almost as a favor, you know, he gets an offer to go to Geneva, New York to play for the Geneva Redlegs. And this is the lowest of the low of minor league baseball. It's a rung of baseball that's so low it doesn't even exist anymore. And you know, he manages to do well there and move his way up. And all of these things just seem incredibly unlikely. In fact, you know, as I went back and looked at it, I think, frankly, it's almost miraculous that Pete Rose ever became Pete Rose.
Mm. And one thing I learned, among many things I learned from your book, is that this famous nickname he was given of Charlie Hustle was not meant as a compliment. It was attached to him by a couple of his rivals who were, in a sense, making fun of that sort of scrappy side of him. But it's a perfect nickname, isn't it?
It's a great nickname. Really becomes his persona. You know, Charlie Hustle is the kind of guy who will sprint down to first base on a walk, the kind of guy who will get into a fight at second base trying to break up a double play, the kind of guy who will, you know, run into a catcher at home plate and break his shoulder in a meaningless exhibition game. That's who Charlie Hustle is. And it is, I think, endlessly interesting that the nickname is bestowed upon him almost as sarcasm. You know, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford are watching him play in a spring training game in 1963, and they find it absurd how hard he is playing. But, you know, it would be easy, you know, say, coming from Mickey Mantle or Whitey Ford to make fun of Pete Rose. I mean, those guys were like the golden gods of baseball, you know, imbued with so much talent. And Pete Rose knew that he had to play hard. He had to work hard in order to make it.
Right. I mean, to be in this world at all, let alone to succeed. One of the things I think I most deeply appreciate about this book is that someone else with other priorities would have probably focused nearly all of his time and attention on the downfall of Pete Rose, the disintegration of his baseball career. And you don't do that. I mean, we are told that story in almost breathtaking detail, but you are just as careful to tell us the story about his glory days. I'm reminded of a TV interview with figure skater Tanya Harding that, for once, focused on her first triple axle and asking about that in great detail. And as she's recounting it, she stops and starts to cry at one point and said, "I'm sorry, nobody ever asks me about this anymore." I mean, of course, her whole life was swallowed up in her scandal. And in some ways, you know, Pete Rose is maybe to some extent a similar sort of story. And you seem to be so anxious for us not to just think about the disaster that engulfed Pete Rose and brought his career down in flames, but you want us to also remember his extraordinary glory as a player before all the rest of that happened.
I'm so glad you mentioned. I agree with that 100%. You know, Pete Rose in some ways has lived for so long and made so many mistakes off the field that we have forgotten who he once was or who he really is. And again, whether you like him or not, whether you defend him or not, Pete Rose was an American icon. He was one of our greatest icons in the second half of the 20th century. And my premise from the start of this project was that we only care about someone's fall, about someone's mistakes, about someone's foibles or implosion in the case of Pete Rose, because we ever cared about them in the first place, you know? And so I wanted to, you know, essentially in this narrative, take us back to this time and place when Pete Rose wasn't the caricature of an old gambler that we know today. He was young and he had dreams, and America saw in him, you know, its own dream and its own story. Sure. And so, you know, my goal with the narrative was to bring him essentially to the mountaintop, because Pete Rose will get to the mountaintop of American life.
Right.
And give folks the view from that mountaintop, because the view was amazing. And then we can watch him tumble and fall off that mountain, because he will, in large part because of his own decisions, his own choices, and his own addiction.
Right. Speaking of mountaintops, you choose to begin the book, your introduction, in September 1985. Briefly explain why this is such a critical moment in his life and career, and why you chose to, in effect, begin your book there.
Only two men in the history of baseball have ever amassed 4,000 total hits. Ty Cobb, and then in 1984, he was joined by Pete Rose. In the history of baseball, two guys have gotten 4,000. And in September 1985, Pete Rose is on the cusp of passing Ty Cobb and claiming the all-time hit record. And, you know, baseball has waned in recent decades as a cultural touchstone, but it was so critical to American culture in 1985. And, you know, this moment in Cincinnati on this night when Pete will pass Ty Cobb is carried live on national television. Networks break into regularly scheduled programming, tell viewers that Pete Rose has just passed Ty Cobb. And if you were alive and watching, you know exactly where you were that night. And 50,000 people were at Riverfront Stadium, where the game took place, in Cincinnati. And when he, you know, safely rounds first and comes back to the bag with a clean single to left center field, the crowd at Riverfront showers him with a standing ovation that will last for 7 minutes. And you know, that's notable, of course. All of those things are notable. But the most notable thing to me is this. You know, as the crowd continues to cheer unabated, you know, Pete Rose, you know, finally can't take it anymore. He becomes emotional. He breaks down and he cries. And it is significant to me because it was the first time anyone had ever seen him do that. And by the way, it was the last time. We haven't seen that kind of emotion from him, Pete Rose, since 1985.
Wow. We're speaking with Keith O'Brien about his brand new book, amazing book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Your book is not only about Pete Rose, but about the game of baseball. And you say in the introduction to the book that the world and the world of Major League Baseball had changed dramatically in the quarter century that Pete Rose had played professional baseball. That is kind of leading up to the start of the fall. What would be a couple of the most significant changes that occurred in baseball during his career? And what I'm really interested in is the changes that really matter in this particular story. That is, how had baseball changed in a way that, in a sense, helped contribute to Pete Rose's self-destruction?
Well, it changed in a couple of important ways. And the first is all about money. You know, in 1963, when Pete is a rookie, almost every ball player had to have some kind of off-season job. You know, guys could not live on a baseball salary. The free agency that comes in the 1970s, which I believe is deserved by players, nevertheless fundamentally alters the game in ways we're still wrestling with today. You know, fans begin to begrudge the fact that players are so highly paid. The owners are even wealthier. And by 1989, when Pete Rose gets in trouble for gambling, and when the rumors of his gambling on baseball first reach the front office of Major League Baseball in New York, the league has just signed its very first billion-dollar television contract. And Peter Uberoff, the outgoing commissioner at the time, is very proud of it. He holds a press conference in New York, and he tells everybody that's billion with a B. And the money in the game and the corporatization of baseball really fundamentally changes it. You know, baseball had once been not just a sport where the players didn't make that much money. They were just also a little unpolished, a little rough around the edges. In the 1960s and 70s, many of our beloved stars said and did things that they could never get away with today. And, you know, in this new world that was coming, you know, Pete Rose is still behaving the same way he always had. He still believes he can do anything, but he can't. And for, you know, for the misdeeds now, he's going to pay a terrible price.
One of the choices you make, and it is such a good choice, and it's one of the most important aspects of the book and fascinating aspects of the book, is that you talk not only about Pete Rose himself, but about some of the people who were in his close orbit, who assisted him in all kinds of ways, and in effect, in some cases, were sort of accessories to the crime, not sort of. And the story of how they were kind of drawn into his orbit, what attracted them to Pete Rose, and then, you know, some of the difficult choices they ultimately had to make. That's an especially interesting facet of all this. We don't have a lot of time, I'm afraid, but maybe you could just choose a couple of the most critical figures and just talk about what was kind of most interesting or compelling about them as you told this story.
Yeah, the figure that comes to mind for me is Tommy Giosa. Tommy Giosa was one of these men in Pete's inner circle. He was one of three men that I interviewed who placed Pete Rose's bets on baseball. And, you know, in past you know, works about Pete, and then many newspaper and magazine articles written in the 1980s and 90s. You know, Tommy is often described with words that I think are not just insulting but inaccurate. You know, they would, you know, call him, you know, a hangers-on or a thug or whatever. And I just don't see it like that at all. You know, Tommy, like many people, was enamored by Pete. And you know, I will say Pete has a charisma about him. He had it then. He still has it now. And when you are, you know, getting Pete's warmth and attention, it does make you feel something. And so Tommy is almost trapped by Pete's gravitational pull. Even when Tommy knows he should maybe stop hanging out with Pete Rose, he should maybe leave Cincinnati, he should maybe stop doing Pete's bidding, he can't. And for these choices, you know, Tommy Giosa, you know, will pay an awful price. Mm. He will ultimately spend more than 2 years in federal prison. In part because Tommy refused to cooperate with investigators in 1989 when they wanted to know what Pete was doing with gamblers.
He was such a loyal friend in so many ways. It sounds like one of the chief reasons that Pete Rose got into his most serious trouble, that is when his gambling escapades expanded beyond other sports to include his own sport of professional baseball, that escalation and just the amount of gambling that he was doing, that is part of what got him in trouble. And also that as he sort of escalated, he also sort of climbed into a different level of the gambling world and in a sense was maybe dealing with less friendly characters. Briefly, can you talk about that aspect of Pete Rose's ultimate self-destruction?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I tried to do with the book was really sort of chart how Pete unraveled, and it really begins in the early 1970s when he at least by that point, if not sooner, is betting with a bookie on the west side of Cincinnati. Pete Rose's part of town, the place where Pete was born and raised, and you know, in the early parts of his gambling career, if you will. You know, Pete was, you know, often placing his bets with friendly bookies, let's say, guys who, you know, would let him carry a debt, guys who weren't even going to rat him out, you know, when and if they got arrested. And by the way, some of them did in the early 1970s. And they don't turn on Pete when they easily could have then. But by the 1980s, that's changed too. You know, Pete is no longer placing bets with bookies that he has known his whole life. He's placing bets with bookies who are total strangers. And some of these men, you know, have their own shady ties. You know, some of these men are on the edge of organized crime. And so, you know, again, Pete is still behaving like he had for years. And is blissfully unaware that the world has changed and that the men he's now gambling with don't really care about Pete Rose. And that's going to matter because one of these bookies will ultimately turn on Pete and he will tell Major League Baseball everything it wants to know. Mm.
Looks like it's our last question, which is Pete Rose steadfastly maintained his innocence when it came to betting on baseball for years and years and years. It's not until 2004 or 2005, I think, that he finally admits to that. You got to actually interview Pete Rose. I wonder, in your conversations, did you get a sense of what prompted him to finally make this admission that, yes, indeed, he had bet on professional baseballs and even on games involving his own team? Why did he admit
that? You know, his admission comes way too late. Why does he admit it in 2004? You know, Pete says that it was time to finally tell the truth. I think there's some ulterior motives there as well. You know, he was hoping that by finally telling the truth, you know, that he would essentially be forgiven and maybe possibly reinstated as an eligible player. Obviously, in 2004, when Pete is now 63 years old, he's not going to be playing baseball. But by being an eligible player, he would then be eligible to be voted on for the Hall of Fame. So, you know, I think that was a key reason why. But it's too late for Pete. And the way he does it is ham-handed and sort of considered, even by some of his friends, to be craven. You know, he doesn't go on, say, the Oprah Winfrey show or your show and apologize and break down and cry. You know, he writes a memoir and you know, receives a very large advance from a publisher to do so. Even in his attempt to apologize and to reckon with what he has done, he somehow makes it worse.
It just adds one more footnote to an ultimately tragic story, and you tell this story so amazingly well in your book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, published by Pantheon Books. Keith O'Brien, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was so pleased to speak with you.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here.
Pete Rose passed away on September 30th, 2024, at the age of 83. And just a few days ago, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred, ruled that Pete Rose and other deceased persons are to be removed from Major League's permanently ineligible list. In other words, the permanent ban from the Hall of Fame has been lifted for Pete Rose. Whether or not he will ultimately be voted into the Hall of Fame is yet another matter, and only time will tell. The time is 8:37. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program, also related to baseball, comes from the Morning Show archives. I'm excited to be reconnecting with best-selling author Kostya Kennedy, who was my guest for the morning show to talk about a very important book of his called Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season, and What Happens When Our Sons Play Football, a very interesting book about the risks of football, and but also the strong hold that it has over a large swath of the American public, including plenty of young people who want to play this game despite its risks. And I'm reconnecting now with Kostya Kennedy to talk about his latest book, which is actually published by Sports Illustrated, titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. It is a marvelous book that celebrates the sport of baseball in very striking fashion by presenting an array of 100 different photographs, many of which capture some of the most important superstars of the game and or critical moments in baseball history. And some of these photographs, on the other hand, capture moments that are, in a sense, much more ordinary and everyday, but help illuminate the public's love of baseball and the special hold that this sport has on so much of the public. It's beautifully done, and I'm excited to be able to speak with Kostya Kennedy about this collection from Sports Illustrated again, The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. Kostya Kennedy, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's great to be on with you.
I'm really impressed with this book. You wrote the foreword to it. Is that your primary involvement in this book, or did you have any hand in the selection of these actual 100 photographs?
No, actually, I did write the foreword, as you mentioned. I was the editor of the book throughout. So I, of course, with a team, with a photo editor and a designer and a couple of other people, but we selected the photos and tried to weave together a bit of a narrative, photograph by photograph, of this wonderful game.
Right. You've made great selections, and we'll talk about some of the specific choices in just a moment. I wonder if you could maybe expand on a really great quote that you include from someone who was a former colleague of yours at Sports Illustrated for about a quarter of a century, Ronald Modra, who says, "When you're shooting baseball, you're waiting. You're waiting, and you're attentive." Explain how, especially once upon a time, being a photographer for the game of baseball was, in such large measure, a waiting game.
Yeah, it's a wonderful quote, and I included that in the foreword of the book because it sums up a lot of the challenge. Ron's a wonderful photographer. I was able, as a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for a long time, and we'd be on stories together. You know, in baseball, perhaps more than any other mainstream sport, you don't know really where the action's going to be, particularly in the field, right? You can get a pitcher in his windup. You know you can get a batter in his stance. But if you're looking for a great fielding play in particular or a play at the base, it's often difficult to know. There's no way to know where it's going to happen. So you have to get a little lucky. And baseball, as we know, you know, what Ron said about taking photographs is also a little bit of what we do as consumers and viewers and those of us who love the game. There are moments of intense action that are very quick, and then you're sort of waiting to see what develops in between. So as he mentioned, when he was shooting the Yankees, for example, in the late 70s and early 80s, when the Yankees were in the field, he would often just train his camera on Greg Nettles, who played third base and was a wonderfully acrobatic and elegant fielder at third base, and he felt he had a good chance of getting a good picture if the ball was hit to him. Now, of course, the ball's only hit to him a few times a game, so it's a risk-reward situation, but he felt, and other photographers who I spoke to felt, that when you're shooting baseball, if you spend a day there and you get one or two really good or even great photographs of the kind that sort of elevate outside the game, it's been a great day, and that's what you can hope for.
Right. I really appreciate some of what you explain in the introduction to the book about how these 100 photographs were selected and how this is, for one thing, by no means the 100 most famous baseball photographs. In a sense, although that would be a great book, but I don't think that would be nearly as interesting a book as this book is, which certainly does have its share of famous photographs from baseball. But that's not all this is. This book is more than that. Explain a little further what went into your thinking process, you and those who helped you select these 100 photographs.
Yeah, it was a big challenge, right? And you start off with the challenge of getting 100 photographs, and you could take it in any number of directions, of course, as you're suggesting in your question. So baseball's about to turn 150. The first openly professional baseball team with the Red Stockings in 1869. And we were using this opportunity, and are using it, to try to tell a narrative of the game, truly to tell a story of baseball over time and over players and over context and over shifts in the game and, of course, over sometimes intersections with the American society at large. So we had sort of a high threshold of what would get in. Of course, the picture had to look pleasing. It had to be aesthetically beautiful or compelling in some way. I wanted pictures to be those that you could stay with a little bit, or you could come back to and maybe see something new or see something in a different light. So there was some depth to a photograph. And then also there was content was crucial, meaning that it wanted to tell a little bit of a story, have a person who was important to the game there, or a game itself, or a time, or, you know, whether it's showing a bullpen cart because of what an important part of the game that was for a little period in the 70s, or whatever it might be. So we're trying to tell over the whole a narrative and have the pictures connect in some way to their time and to the overall story of the game. I should just mention briefly, with each picture we have about 250 words of text or so, we hope evocative text, which give a little background and context, a little bit extra to the photograph, so people can really dig in and understand what's happening and what they're looking at.
Right. And I also appreciate the fact that the book is separated by time period. So, for instance, the first section of the book is titled Beginnings, appropriately enough, and spans the years 1869 to 1919. And there are some very, very fascinating pictures in this section that include some early luminaries of the game, including Cy Young and Ty Cobb caught in action. I actually would love to have you say just a quick word about a photograph in this section, which you headline "Beginning of the World." This is a photograph taken in Boston in the fall of 1903, and it is a remarkable image indeed.
Yes, it's a picture of the first World Series games at a place called Huntington Avenue Grounds in Boston, and it's a big widespread shot. There weren't that you mentioned the Ty Cobb picture from 1910, which was a beautiful action picture. There wasn't that much action in those days as what people shot, but this was not action, but a big wide angle looking at the field. And what's so remarkable about it is you see all the people who've come to watch the game, and they're just crowding in. They're on the outfield. They're standing on the big slatted wooden fence. They're packed in to see this incredible spectacle, and very close to the field, as one can see, much closer than you would ever have people today. Obviously, you wouldn't have people on the field at all today, but it's an incredible photograph, I think, because it evokes such a time. It evokes the excitement of this new game. It's relatively new. It's 1903. This is the first World Series. Shows so many people there, so close to the game. You can see people aren't. You understand by looking at this picture that people don't hit the ball as far as they do now in those days, because you wouldn't be able to have people so encroached. So there's a lot about it, along with period advertisement signs for a local shoe shop and things like that, which really make it a powerful picture to look at, I think.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you made mention of the fact that we have very few true action shots from the early years of baseball, which makes the image, for instance, of Ty Cobb all the more precious. It's well, you describe it, this wonderful photograph that captures Ty Cobb and his greatness.
Yeah, so he's coming really hard into third base, basically almost barreling over to third baseman. You see the his foot hitting the bag. Again, these pictures become so revealing. You can see that the bag is kind of a soft bag. It's almost a pillow. It's changed a lot over time. And there's dirt flying everywhere. The umpire in the background is looking to make his call on the play. Cobb has an expression of great intensity on his face. And it's an amazing picture because, it's Ty Cobb, right? And we're seeing him in 1910 and at the height of his powers and what he was as the greatest player in the game at that time. And as we were saying, it's also very rare in those days to see action like this. This really stood out. There are some beautiful pictures from that time, like the World Series one we just described, but often the player pictures are portraits on the sideline of a pitcher going into his windup, perhaps, or a batter taking a little bit of a swing. The action photography didn't really begin until the 20s, 30s, and then more so in the 40s and 50s. It was much harder to get because of the quality of camera in those days, and it was just not in vogue, really, to do it nearly as much as it would become.
Right. We're speaking with Kostya Kennedy, the editor of a wonderful new book from Sports Illustrated called The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. I know people will greedily devour the chapter that covers 1920 to 1947, and you title it From Ruth to Robinson. In many ways, that title is all that we need to hear, although there are a whole lot of other luminaries from this period of the game who are captured here as well. I want to just ask you about the photograph that you chose of Babe Ruth. I mean, as you just said, by this point, photography had advanced to the point where there are just countless possibilities, yeah, in terms of great photographs of the wonderful Babe Ruth in action. But I love the photo that you selected, although I've never seen it before. Explain what led you to choose it.
Yeah, so as you say, a player like Ruth or DiMaggio or later on Pete Rose or any number of players, there are many choices you could make. One thing to remember is, so say something like Babe Ruth called shot in the 1932 World Series. There's not really a great picture of it, right? There's a little tiny, grainy image, but there's not a picture that you would even consider including in a book of great photography or as something to really hold up at a good size. But there are many, many pictures of Ruth in many different ways. We chose a picture where he's finishing his mighty swing. You see him sort of in full power. His hips are swiveled. The back of his leg is extended. His front leg, his right leg is bent, and his bat is high on the follow-through. He just hit a home run. He's looking up at it. Both the catcher, who's risen from his crouch, and the umpire also following the flight path of the ball. And you also see the shadows on the dirt there, the shadows of both Ruth and the catcher behind him. It's at Sportsman Park in St. Louis, where Babe and a lot of other people hit quite well against the Browns in those days. And it just seemed you were really seeing Babe Ruth doing what he did. Obviously, he did so many other things, and he was a big, larger-than-life star outside the game, and the way he was so jovial and the raconteur and all that, and also did so much on the field. He could run well, and he was obviously a great pitcher. He did so much well. But the thing that he did, obviously, was hit home runs. And here you are seeing him, the power of Babe Ruth, on just, you know, on just a day in October in 1926, and it's one of his home runs, and it really seemed to encapsulate with this picture to tell the larger story of who Babe Ruth was and what he did for the game.
I love this photograph so much. This whole section is peppered with superstars from Joe DiMaggio to Ted Williams to the legendary Satchel Paige. I really appreciate the thoughtful choice you made to capture the great Lou Gehrig. This is another photograph I've never seen before. I've seen ones like it. There are all kinds of photographs from this powerful, poignant moment when Lou Gehrig bade farewell to the game he loved so much. But describe to our listeners the photograph that is here, and again, why you thought this was the perfect photograph to include.
So it's Lou at Yankee Stadium on July 4th, 1939, and he's on the field with several microphones set up on tripods in front of him, and he's delivering the speech that we've come to know and has made its way into the American lexicon of the luckiest man speech, where he knows that he has ALS, and he's still says he considers himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. It's a powerful picture for what you see in Lou with his head slightly bent. He's not actually speaking. He's in pause at that moment. And also the men you see behind him looking at him and understanding the courage that they're seeing. Here the case, you know, Lou Gehrig was an all-time, obviously, great, great, great ball player. There are plenty of pictures of him hitting or fielding or doing something that we could have shown. But what Lou Gehrig did, in the way he faced this disease and in his bravery and composure, really slipped the bounds of the game. And there aren't as many times as one would think that baseball does that. Of course, it's wrapped up into American society, but moments like Lou Gehrig or Jackie Robinson, Roberto Clemente, aren't quite as many as one would think. And this really seemed to be one where he was making a mark not just on the baseball world, but on the world at large, and felt like the right way to honor him and what he's given us.
Right. One very special moment in baseball history was the perfect game thrown by Don Larsen. And please describe the great photograph that is here that captures this moment on October 8th, 1956.
Yeah, one of the things I love about it, so it's he's in the arms of Yogi Berra, Don Larsen is having just finished his perfect game, and it shows you sort of what a big guy Don Larsen is, because Yogi wasn't tall, but Yogi was a big heavy catcher, and it's Don who's picking up Yogi Berra, so it gives you a sense. I think Larsen was about 6'4", and gives you a sense of his size and his strength. And you see people, security people, and everybody spilling onto the field and coming close to them. The Yankees are beginning to celebrate. The Dodgers' first base coach is turning to leave the field. And again, it captures a singular moment. Here was a case when one of the landmark games, you know, one of the 10 or 15 games that will go down as the all-time games in baseball history, there was a great picture of it, and it was a great moment. And Larson, whose career otherwise might not have merited a telling in the overall story of baseball, but certainly through this October day in 1956 warranted being in there.
Absolutely. I want to mention that there are several photographs that have a local connection to our listeners. For instance, a really interesting picture of the Braves having just moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta, and that story is talked about. There's a great picture of the Kenosha Comets. They were one of the women's teams active during World War II and just after, along with the Racine Belles. But the photograph actually shows some talented women of the Kenosha Comets and all kinds of wonderful photographs to take us up to the present day. I want to finish real quick by having you talk about a great photograph that is not on the field but in a restaurant. The headline says The Art of the Craft, and the great Ted Williams is sitting down to a meal with two much younger players. Explain why this image is here. It is wonderful, but why did you want to include it?
You know, it's great that you bring this one up. I think of all these pictures, and when you live with them and look at them, I really love so many of them, and it's hard to choose. But in some ways, this is my favorite photograph, or the one that I think about sometimes when I'm away from the book as much or more than any others. So it's Williams, as you said, and he's sitting at a lunch table in Florida during spring training of 1986. And he's there with Don Mattingly and Wade Boggs. And this is at the height of the time when Boggs is, you know, multiple-time batting champion, and Mattingly is in the heart of his MVP-caliber seasons. And they're staring at Ted, who's sort of in a half swing because he's talking hitting, and he's showing the way he turns on a pitch. And you can see the way his hands are on top of one another. It's just such an amazing picture about baseball going generation to generation. One beautiful detail of this is that Williams has a cloth napkin tucked over the front of his shirt to preserve his shirt, which is what men of his age and at that time period did. And the younger men aren't doing that, right? And it's just another detail which underscores the different generations, but they're together around baseball, and
you're right.
It's an incredible thing.
And you can kind of see the reverence and respect that is on the faces of these young players sitting in the presence of one of the towering legends of the game. It really is a beautiful image. The whole book is wonderful. Again, it's titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. This is published by Sports Illustrated, and the editor, Kostya Kennedy, also responsible for a really nice introduction for the book. Kostya Kennedy, you've done it again, and I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this wonderful book. Best wishes.
Oh, and to you. Thanks so much for having me on. This was really great. I appreciate the time, and so glad you've enjoyed the book.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, in honor of National Military Appreciation Month, I'm replaying my interview with Daniel P. Bolger, author of Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. It is the story of the Hagel brothers from Nebraska who fought together during the Vietnam War. Part of what makes their story quite intriguing is that these two brothers each held very different views about the Vietnam War itself and America's role in it, but nevertheless fought side by side courageously, saving one another's lives, quite literally. We'll hear that story tomorrow. On Wednesday, we look forward to welcoming back to our studios Dr. Art Sear to offer his commentary on current events and issues. On Thursday, a look at the earliest days of radio with Anthony Rudell and his book, Hello, Everybody. On Friday, we return to the topic of baseball, this time to speak with Gerald Early about his book, Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And don't forget the morning show archive and the morning show podcast. Look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be cloudy, breezy, and cool, a high of just 55 degrees. Rain likely overnight with a low of 45. Rain tomorrow as well, high of just 53. And a similar forecast for Wednesday. We do finally see sunshine and slightly warmer temperatures as we get to Thursday, Friday, and into the weekend. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha Racine.